Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar, The Roots, Applications, and Trajectory of the Church Autonomy Doctrine, featuring an expert panel. Branton Nestor, an associate at Gibson Dunn, Professor Thomas Berg, the James L. Oberstar Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, Professor Leslie Griffin, the William S. Boyd Professor of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, William S. Boyd School of Law, and Alex Luchnitzer, the Associate Vice President and Associate Legal Director at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Our moderator today is Amanda Saltz. Amanda is counsel for Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Amanda, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thanks for the introduction, Marco, and thank you to all of our panelists for joining us today for a discussion on church autonomy. Really looking forward to getting into it. So in just a bit, we'll start off with opening statements from each panelist, then I'll have some questions for each of you, and finally, we'll open it up for audience Q&A. So as Marco said, feel free to drop any questions in the chat box. But before turning it over to the panelists, I want to just give a brief overview of the church autonomy doctrine and then highlight some key issues that have been percolating in the lower courts. So first, what is the church autonomy doctrine? As the Supreme Court explained it in its 2020 opinion in Our Lady of Guadalupe School v. Morrissey Beru, church autonomy is a constitutional principle rooted in both religion clauses of the First Amendment, and it protects religious institutions' rights to decide for themselves matters of faith, doctrine, and internal governance without government interference. The Supreme Court's two most recent church autonomy cases, Our Lady of Guadalupe and Hosanna Tabor v. EEOC from 2012, both involve a particular aspect of church autonomy called the ministerial exception, which applies to employment discrimination claims brought against church entities or religious entities. But earlier Supreme Court cases applied church autonomy principles to disputes over church property and authority of religious leadership. And lower courts applied the doctrine in those contexts, as well as others where adjudicating civil claims would improperly require judges to delve into religious issues. Although the Supreme Court has made it clear that a court cannot rule against a religious entity if doing so would violate the church autonomy doctrine, its opinions have left open some key questions about the nature of the church autonomy right and then the timing in which it must be addressed. So as a result, judges across the federal and the state courts have reached different conclusions on these issues. And one example that illuminates the varying approaches is a recent en banc Ninth Circuit case called Huntsman, where all 11 judges on the en banc panel ruled for the church, but the 6-judge majority did so on the merits of the plaintiff's fraud claim, while 5 judges would have instead resolved the case on church autonomy grounds. And one of those judges went even further to opine that because church autonomy bars the claim, addressing the merits, even to rule for the church, was legal error. So as these issues continue to percolate in the lower courts, it's possible that the doctrine will regain traction with the Supreme Court, which of course is the only court that can definitively resolve any of these open questions about the nature of the right and the proper timing for addressing it. But that's much of what we'll be discussing today. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to you, Branton, to provide some more context on the history and development of the doctrine.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's an interesting puzzle and an important puzzle. So I'm looking forward to working through some of the doctrinal and historical wrinkles on this call and probably afterwards as well. So for background, the church autonomy doctrine, as Amanda mentioned, protects the right of religious institutions to decide for themselves, free from state interference, matters of church government, as well as those of faith and doctrine. The contemporary doctrine is grounded in both religion clauses. The free exercise clause protects the government from interfering in the freedom of religious groups, and the establishment clause prohibits government involvement in ecclesiastical decisions. And the Supreme Court's leading decisions, Hosanna Tabor, 9-0, and Our Lady, grounded the doctrine in history, tradition, and precedent. while church autonomy has deep historical roots and relatively broad acceptance, at least at a high level of generality today, there are several challenging questions of exceptional importance that split courts and divide scholars. One important debate centers on the relationship between church autonomy and judicial power. Is church autonomy rooted in our history and tradition? Is it a legitimate and valid doctrine? Two, does church autonomy limit the power of civil courts to exercise judicial power over ecclesiastical decisions? And three, if those limits exist, what are they? How are they structured? How do they interact with contemporary civil procedure questions that are the types of things that early courts were not focused on? And this is a live debate with separate writings from, among others, Judge Park and Delia in the Second Circuit, Judge Richardson and Palmer in the Fourth Circuit, Judge Ho and Judge Oldham in the Fifth Circuit, McGraney decisions, and Judge Bumate and Judge Bress in the Ninth Circuit. Well, what I'm hoping to do with my remaining time is to set up a little bit of the history and tradition of the doctrine and tease out some of the early implications, at least at a high level generality, that will hopefully set up the debate that we're going to have on this call and that we'll, I'm sure, continue to have in weeks and months and maybe years to come, depending on how long it takes for the court to step in and intervene. So the first point I want to make is that church autonomy is old. Its roots are older than America, but if church autonomy is old, so too are church-state conflicts. Church autonomy in England, at least after the Protestant Reformation, was often more theoretical than real. And as Professor McConnell has pointed out, established religion came to the shores of the early colonists. One hallmark of these early colonial establishments was government control over the doctrine, structure, and personnel of the state church. Religious establishments, which were sometimes motivated by religion, sometimes by theology, sometimes by politics, generated substantial debate, but they were at least a relatively uniform and fixed feature of early English and early American colonial law. The church autonomy doctrine inaugurated by the First Amendment marked a rejection of religious establishments, at least at the federal level. Church-state relations underwent a significant change in early America with expanded protections for religious institutions or religious matters. The change was sometimes political, sometimes philosophical, sometimes theological, but it reflected over time a jurisdictional line between civil and ecclesiastical matters. And the First Amendment, which rejected a federal establishment, prevented the federal government from appointing ministers, and the Free Exercise Clause prevented it from interfering with the freedom of religious groups to select their own ministers. This understanding of religion and the religion clause was reflected in the original public understanding of church autonomy in early America, and state establishments, for similar reasons, and over time, similarly withered, reflecting similar non-establishment and free exercise principles. The doctrine on the ground was challenging. Church autonomy was a new principle. Working out church autonomy in conventional civil procedure, property, corporate, other black letter contexts was quite challenging. Church autonomy is a new principle and didn't come with a playbook. And early civil courts were working out how to apply it in the variety of black letter contexts in which it arose. But the general rule that emerged, articulated by Watson, which itself had cited a bevy of earlier state decisions, confirmed that it was generally impermissible for the government to contradict a church's determination of who can act as ministers or how it should manage its ecclesiastical affairs. The leading restatement comes from Watson, which was, whenever questions of discipline or faith or ecclesiastical rule, custom or law have been decided by the highest of the church adjudicatories to which the matter has been carried, the legal tribunals must accept such decisions as final and as binding on them. And over matters strictly and purely ecclesiastical in character, such as matters of theological controversy, church discipline, ecclesiastical government, conformity of the members of the church to the church standards, the civil courts routinely and consistently explained that over such matters they exercise, quote, no jurisdiction. And civil courts, both before and after Watson, routinely explained that they lacked jurisdiction or the power to inquire into matters of church government, faith, or doctrine. And the general approach was that over matters purely ecclesiastical, civil courts could exercise no jurisdiction. And two, over matters where there was a civil hook, a property interest or civil right at stake, the civil courts owed deference to the competent religious authority and cannot exercise jurisdiction or a judicial power to inquire into the merits of that determination. And so the trifecta of principles are really what's driving it here. One is a free exercise principle. Limitations on judicial review were explained as protecting the freedom of religious institutions. A second principle is a non-establishment principle. Limitations on judicial review were viewed as keeping civil courts out of ecclesiastical disputes. And the third principle was voluntary association. If individuals joined churches, they had voluntarily consented to the authority of the church, at least over ecclesiastical matters. This was the general black letter doctrine that predominated. But to say that church autonomy was fundamental is not to say that it was unlimited. It had limits. One set of limits were substantive. Church autonomy only protected matters of church government, faith, and doctrine. And it also could not displace valid civil jurisdiction over civil matters. Early courts debated how to draw this civil ecclesiastical line, but they acknowledged that there was a substantive line and substantive limits to what the doctrine protected. And two, to my great surprise in reading the early cases, there were a variety of procedural limitations. Early American courts would often conduct jurisdictional review, fraud or collusion review, arbitrariness review, even sometimes a religious question review. But the main upshot from all this is that early American courts, one, broadly acknowledged church autonomy principles, two, also recognized that church autonomy had limits, and three, even in explaining those limits, described such limits as consistent with broad protection for church autonomy rightly understood.
Great. Well, thank you, Brandon. Leslie, let's go over to you.
Okay. Well, thank you to the Federalist Society and today's participants for inviting us and sponsoring this session about church autonomy. Now, church autonomy, it sounds like a good idea, like protecting religious freedom. Church autonomy supposedly prohibits courts from resolving controversies over religious doctrine and practice, or making a religious decision for a church. The First Amendment protects the right of religious institutions to decide for themselves, free from state interference, matters of church government, as well as those of faith and doctrine. In the words of the Supreme Court, to protect the right of churches and other religious institutions to decide matters of faith and doctrine without government intrusion is essential, and that includes intrusion by the courts. Sounds good, maybe like religious freedom. But the rule has gone much further than that. Church autonomy gives power to religious institutions to live by their own rules and thus to disobey laws they don't like, all in the name of the First Amendment. The ministerial exception, which is a favorite of church autonomy fans, is a great example of that. If you're a minister, your employer has an affirmative defense to end your lawsuit. The ministerial rule keeps the facts of the cases from ever being heard. The religious institutions are free from obedience to all the anti-discrimination laws in our country. Every single one of them, race, gender, sexual orientation, age, health, retaliation, disabilities, wage discrimination. Sadly, in my mind, the Supreme Court in Hosanna Tabor, its first ministerial exception case, said it didn't matter if you had a religious reason to fire someone. If one is a minister, you can do whatever you want to him or her. Is there any alternative to such a broad church immunity autonomy approach that prohibits most employees of religious organizations, which includes churches, seminaries, mosques, temples, synagogues, madrasas, religious hospitals, elementary and secondary schools, colleges and universities, and law schools from having any civil rights? I think the ministerial exception cases, like the property cases, could all be decided on neutral principles of law that govern everyone. Neutral principles means that sometimes the churches would win when they fire someone who's a bad minister, but they would lose when they discriminate against their employees. A jury or a judge might believe that in one case, a person was fired because of her race, or in another because she was a poor minister. Judging the cases on the facts would mean some win, some lose, as usually happens in court. But the church autonomy ministerial exception rule means every case is decided for the church, and the facts are buried and forgotten. for example, the two women that the Ninth Circuit called teachers were called ministers by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so their age and health discrimination claims ended. Now, in that case, Marcy Baru, one teacher claimed age discrimination, and the second asked for leave because she was suffering from breast cancer. In Hosanna Tabor, the teacher was trying to return to work after a sick leave for narcolepsy. These churches claim not to support age discrimination or disabilities discrimination for religious reasons. Yet the ministerial exception allows them to practice it, even though age and disabilities discrimination have nothing to do with their religion. Many supporters of religious freedom think church autonomy is the greatest thing for religious freedom. They believe churches always do good things and are best at seeking the truth. The child sexual abuse cases should teach you otherwise. Church autonomy allows religions to pick their priests without any interference because they're ministers. So some courts have dismissed negligent hiring, negligent supervision, negligent employment lawsuits against churches or schools or hospitals because it's a religious decision to keep a priest or fire him. That protects institutional churches and their hierarchies from any government oversight, even when the religions have been abusing children for centuries. Now, some people will say, oh no, we don't go that far to permit child sexual abuse. But the courts have. And if you believe the churches, which means hospitals and schools as well as churches, have autonomy to be free from governmental interference, then the children, black and brown men and women, gays, lesbians, and trans individuals, the elderly, the sick, the disabled, those who face wage discrimination, and the whistleblowers will all suffer harm while the church enjoys its autonomy from laws that protect civil rights. A lot of people think the churches don't need to follow the anti-discrimination laws, and they want churches to have absolute freedom. Now, that protects the institution, but not the individuals. Think of what those words, church autonomy, mean. The word church emphasizes institutions because the church is one. Why do I dislike that emphasis on institutions, not individuals? Because the framers understood that their government had to protect individuals from churches as well as from the states. Individuals were killed in the European wars of religion because religious institutions ruled and allowed harm. The framers gave us the distinctive establishment clause to keep both religion and politics from overruling individuals. Now, today, in the church autonomy era, the establishment clause is under attack. That means more protection for churches instead of individuals. That's what the church autonomy doctrine protects. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Alex, let's go over to you.
Thank you, Amanda. The church autonomy doctrine has long been a limited principle that protects religious institutions from direct governmental interference in how they govern themselves and what they believe. But in recent years, some litigants have endeavored to greatly expand the scope of the doctrine in a manner that would give religious organizations broad rights to ignore a wide variety of laws. I'll illustrate this trend by discussing the arguments being made by the petitioners in a case that the Supreme Court will hear next Monday, Catholic Charities Bureau versus Wisconsin Labor Review and Industry Commission. But let me start with some brief legal background on religious freedom law. A bedrock principle of that jurisprudence is that if a law is neutral with respect to religion and generally applicable, it does not violate the right to freely exercise religion, even if it imposes significant burdens on religious practice. The Supreme Court announced that rule in a 1990 decision, Employment Division versus Smith, and it reaffirmed that principle in its 2020 decision in Our Lady of Guadalupe, stating that our Constitution's protections for religious freedom do not mean that religious institutions enjoy a general immunity from secular laws. Our Lady of Guadalupe was also the first Supreme Court decision to use the term church autonomy to describe a doctrine of religious freedom law. The court defined the doctrine as protecting religious institutions' independence in matters of faith and doctrine and in closely linked matters of internal government. The cases that the court pointed to as previous applications of the doctrine have a narrow scope. They held that courts and other governmental bodies cannot decide questions of religious doctrine and override the decisions of church tribunals about church leadership or control of church property. And as we've discussed, they also held that laws prohibiting discrimination in employment cannot be applied to employment decisions by religious organizations concerning their clergy and other employees whose duties are religious. But in recent years, some litigants have been attempting to convince courts to expand the church autonomy doctrine far beyond the limited scope of those cases. A prime example is the Catholic Charities case that will be argued before the Supreme Court next Monday. In that lawsuit, five Catholic-affiliated social service agencies are seeking a statutory religious exemption from a Wisconsin unemployment tax law. The statute provides exemptions for houses of worship and for religiously affiliated organizations operated primarily for religious purposes. The social service agencies are incorporated separately from their affiliated Catholic diocese and therefore concede that they do not qualify for the exemption for houses of worship. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court interpreted the exemption for religiously affiliated organizations as covering only organizations whose activities are substantively religious in nature, as opposed to ones who merely assert that they act out of a religious motive. Under this test, the petitioner social service agencies were denied the exemption because although they provide services for religious reasons, they do not inject religious content into their services. In their briefing before the U.S. Supreme Court, the social service agency's lead argument is the church autonomy doctrine. The agencies assert that the Wisconsin court's decision violated the doctrine by giving their affiliated diocese an incentive to change how they are structured, as the Catholic agencies would be entitled to an exemption if they were merged into the diocese. The agencies also contend that the Wisconsin court violated the doctrine by giving them incentives to proselytize when providing services, which would be contrary to their religious teachings, but would also entitle them to an exemption. These arguments seek a drastic expansion of the church autonomy doctrine. The Supreme Court has never suggested that government action violates the doctrine merely because it provides a religious entity some incentive to change how it is structured or to change its behavior or beliefs. Rather, the doctrine only protects houses of worship from direct governmental interference with their governance and beliefs. And accepting the Catholic agency's arguments would lead to radical results. First, no statute or court would ever be able to limit any religious exemptions anywhere in the law to any subset of religious or religiously affiliated organizations. Any line that could conceivably be drawn to limit the scope of a religious exemption would be unconstitutional under the petitioner agency's views, because it would give some entity an incentive to change how it is structured or what it believes. As a result, legislatures would become reluctant to enact religious exemptions and would likely repeal existing ones. This would harm the religious freedom of religious entities instead of advancing it. Second, the Catholic agency's view of the church autonomy doctrine would effectively overrule the Smith rule that generally applicable religion-neutral laws do not violate the Constitution's protections for the free exercise of religion. The agency's arguments are essentially that if a government action gives a religious entity an incentive to change how it behaves, that violates the church autonomy doctrine. Simply put, this legal theory would give religious organizations a right to ignore any law they do not like. For example, a religious group whose beliefs require it to incorporate heavy drug use into its activities would have a right to ignore drug laws because the laws give it incentives to change its beliefs. For the same reason, a religious group whose beliefs call for plural marriage would have a right to ignore laws prohibiting polygamy. And the ministerial exception doctrine, which currently applies only to employees who perform religious duties, would automatically be expanded to all employees of religious organizations. That's because the current limitation on the doctrine's scope gives religious organizations an incentive to assign religious duties to employees so that they are not covered by anti-discrimination laws. Indeed, in recent cases, litigants have relied on the church autonomy doctrine to argue that religious institutions should be more broadly exempted from employment laws than they are under the ministerial exception. Litigants have also used the church autonomy doctrine to argue that religious organizations should be shielded from sex abuse claims, as Leslie just discussed, from fraud claims, from defamation claims, from health insurance coverage requirements, and even from immigration rules. So hopefully, to prevent these types of abuses of the church autonomy doctrine, the Supreme Court will reaffirm the doctrine's limited scope in the Catholic Charities case.
Thank you, Alex. Tom, let's turn it to you.
Hi, thank you. So I'm going to talk about the Catholic Charities case too, and have a slightly different perspective than Alex. Although I do acknowledge that there are complications in the case. So let me tie it to church autonomy first and talk a little bit about church autonomy. I think there are two strains in the church autonomy doctrine. One might be called substantive autonomy or kind of substantive separation. That is autonomy for the freedom of the church to make its decisions. And the other strain in the doctrine over the years has been what you might call a sort of issue separation, that the courts or the government should not be involved in deciding religious questions. And the ministerial exception actually has historically rested on both of those strains of autonomy. In part, the courts have thought that it's really important to let churches have and religious organizations have control over their leaders because of the importance of a leader in leading the flock and so on. And you see that in the ministerial exception decisions. But another part of the doctrine over the years has been that courts simply do not want to be involved in the kind of project that Leslie proposes, which is over and over again deciding whether someone was a good minister, or whether the decision was made on some other ground. Now, I will grant that in recent ministerial exception decisions, the court has emphasized what I call the substantive reason for the ministerial exception, which is the freedom of the church. And it is not said as much about the inclination of judges not to want to get involved in these issues and making religious determinations like, was this person a good minister or not, which inevitably comes up in Title VII cases. But I do think that the second, the issue separation rationale remains part of what inclines judges not to want to get involved in these cases. Now, let's turn to the Catholic Charities case. And Alex has described, I think, some of the arguments of Catholic Charities, but at least not all of the arguments of Catholic Charities and their amici. So the basis on which the Washington, the Wisconsin Supreme Court held that Catholic Charities was not exempt, it was under a statute that said you are exempt from the unemployment compensation scheme if you are engaged in, if you operated primarily for religious purposes. And the court read that to require not only a religious motivation, although the word purpose sounds like motivation to me, but the court required also that the activity itself be primarily religious in nature. And then it proceeded to make all sorts of judgments about what counted as religious. It said that if you do something that looks like what others do for secular reasons, then it's not religious. By that principle, for example, a Muslim wearing a beard on the basis of the Quran is not doing anything religious because other people wear beards for secular reasons. That just doesn't add up. The other thing that the court said was it's not primarily religious if you are serving people outside of the faith or employing people outside of the faith. All of these factors added up to the judgment that the Catholic Charities was not engaged in a primarily religious endeavor. And there's just sort of one judgment after another about what counts as religious. In other words, this was not a case where the legislature drew a line and the court simply applied a line that struck a sort of balance. The court was out there making theological and religious judgments about what counted as religious. That implicates the issue separation part of the church autonomy doctrine that has been there in the church property cases and in other church autonomy cases. So I think there's more going on here than just what we've heard so far. Now, Alex raises a good point that if we're going to have exemptions at all, legislatures have to be able to draw lines. And if you're going to say that anything that affects the way the church operates or the religious organization operates is unconstitutional, then the result is going to be that legislatures aren't going to adopt exemptions at all. But I think there are some ways that the court could rule on that this particular endeavor that the Wisconsin Supreme Court jumped into is unconstitutional without causing those kinds of consequences. So the first thing is that the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision was, again, just one sort of subjective theological judgment after another about what counted as religious. And that raises the concern about government, in this case courts, making those sorts of judgments. The other is that there's a serious concern about equality here between religious denominations and between different ways of understanding one's religious mission. The Supreme Court has cases like Larson versus Valenti that emphasize that discrimination among and between religious denominations is the core wrong under the Establishment Clause. And for a court to say that you are not religious if you serve other people outside of the faith is raises very serious concerns about government making just sort of discriminating between different ways of being religious. Now, any line might do that, but let me just raise one point here about why this one again is particularly objectionable. This is a statute about employees, and if the exemption had something, was with the line drawn on the exemption, had something to do with protecting employees who, for example, were outside the faith. Then I could imagine saying that would be a line that bore some relationship to the purposes of the statute. For example, I do think that when the contraception mandate was decided a few years ago, or before the courts a few years ago, there was an argument that the government should have some ability to protect non-Catholic employees who were working for Catholic organizations but did not agree with Catholic doctrine on contraception. Okay, so there's at least some argument there. But here the court has said, in an employment context, you lose your ability to claim a religious exemption, not solely because you employ people outside of the faith, but because you serve people outside of the faith. There's no connection between that line and the purpose of the statute. And if we care at all about equality among denominations in drawing exemptions, we will require that there be some connection between the scope of the exemption and the underlying statute. So I'll stop there and talk more afterwards, after we get into the questions.
Great. Well, thank you, Tom, and thank you to all of you. We've covered a lot of ground already. I have some questions for you, and then as a reminder to the audience, we'll have time for some audience Q&A. So we've already got some filtering in, but feel free to drop any questions in the chat box. Brandon, coming back to you. So I mentioned at the outset, Supreme Court hasn't clearly indicated whether lower courts must rule on church autonomy and do so immediately, or whether they can instead wait and instead rule for a church entity on the merits without ever addressing church autonomy rights. And the lower courts and judges have taken different stances on this. So what do you, from your view, do the history and development of the doctrine suggest about whether and when courts must address church autonomy?
So this is a live issue. Courts are splitting. Lower court judges are digging the history themselves. And it's a live issue with a deep circuit split that's developing. I think the history and tradition provide some guidance, but don't totally close the gaps on all the relevant doctrinal questions. So maybe we'll start with the high level history and tradition, some general lessons, and then drill down the specifics. So the history and tradition of the church autonomy doctrine instructed that, one, church autonomy limited the power of civil courts to exercise jurisdiction over or to inquire into ecclesiastical matters reserved to ecclesiastical authorities. And two, this limitation on the exercise of judicial power was motivated by both free exercise considerations, protecting the freedom of the church, and non-establishment considerations, preventing civil court interference or entailment in church matters. That might be the issue separation that Tom mentioned. But the history does not resolve everything. Old courts were focused on old issues. They weren't running through Mohawks, interlocutory appeal standards. They weren't through contemporary doctrinal buckets. But I do think the history and tradition suggests some limits and some lessons, even if at the end of the day, defining what constitutes an ecclesiastical matter is the ballgame. So first, the general lessons. And this is probably a point of agreement. One, it probably imposes some mandatory limits on civil courts. It probably rules out some suits, and it probably rules out some modes of discovery and inquiry. And two, aside from the mandatory limits, it probably suggests some prudential safeguards in civil courts. How civil courts and the exercise of their prudential judgment, should exercise their discretion to proceed. The more specific questions, the order of operations doctrine and the interlocutory appeals doctrine, I think raise extremely hard issues, sort of split academics debate. But to take the order of operations question, I think there's probably two lessons from the old 19th century cases. Civil courts and the exercise of their discretion can address church autonomy at the threshold. Order of operations doctrine is a prudential ordering doctrine. Civil courts can generally choose the order of issues, aside from some threshold and jurisdictional other related matters, but they generally have broad discretion to choose the order of operations. And two, the church autonomy considerations we've talked about here, the free exercise and non-establishment considerations, those are at least relevant to that prudential judgment on how to take the order of operations. Judge Richardson, my old boss in the Fourth Circuit, wrote in Palmer, we need not say that a court court's inquiry into a minister's employment, i.e. something covered by the ministerial exception, is unconstitutional in order to say that it is, you know, quote, as a prudential matter, a bad idea to become so entangled. And so, you know, we can fight about how to exercise prudence, but I think there's probably broad agreement that, you know, at least in the order of operations context, church autonomy can inform the exercise of that prudence. But the harder point, the more controversial point is, do you have to address church autonomy at the threshold? This is the Bumate Brest debate in Huntsman. And I think there's two ideas that I want to put on the table that really I think are sort of the analytical turning points for whether you have to the threshold. One is the non-establishment idea, you know, the issue separation idea. If church autonomy limits civil court authority, you know, you might think that the old cases where civil courts are saying we lack jurisdiction to even inquire into or to examine these types of matters, that might suggest a structural constitutional constraint that requires before you proceed, making sure that your procession is not going to violate the church autonomy doctrine. A second idea is a franchise idea. If church autonomy protects churches, you might ask whether the very process of inquiry is, you know, the old NLRB case says the very process of inquiry imposes burdens on churches. Maybe it's a functional burden. Maybe it taxes, warps, drains church resources. Early courts didn't talk specifically in these types of terms, but you know, they did explain that the very process of exercise jurisdiction over ecclesiastical matters would disrupt or undermine church authority. Relatedly, maybe it's a formal idea, something akin to sphere sovereignty. The old churches explained that even exercising jurisdiction over inquiring into ecclesiastical matters would violate the formal authority of churches and the formal constraints on early civil courts. So I think that's at least the framework for thinking about these things. So some cases are easy. A purely ecclesiastical dispute where litigants ask somebody to reverse an excommunication unattached from any civil rights seems like an easy case. Some cases, and I think the cases we're all thinking about, are harder, but I think probably it's worth agreeing on the roadmap before we start marching off the trails.
Great. Well, thank you for the overview on that. I know it's a very complicated question, as you said, a live issue. So thanks for the recap. So Wesley, you mentioned during your opening remarks that the church autonomy doctrine has been applied to insulate religious entities from sexual abuse claims that victims bring against their abusers. But one could also imagine some examples in which declining to apply the doctrine could prevent religious entities from protecting their members from sexual abuse, such as where a religious entity can't fire a religious leader or inform its members of abuse without subjecting itself to a lawsuit for wrongful termination, defamation, or the like. So how should this important interest in protecting victims from sexual abuse factor into the development of the church autonomy doctrine when the interest seems to cut both ways?
Well, because I think the fundamental principle is neutral principles of law. And neutral principles of law should be deciding these cases, not church autonomy, because what the church autonomy role is say, I didn't mention sexual harassment claims. They get dismissed under the new church autonomy routine. But if you say everybody has to be, and that's why some scholars have written that the constitutional requirement is really neutral principles of law, because what that means is if you fire an abuser and the abuser sues you, the abuser's going to lose in court. If you do things to protect the abusers instead of revealing them, then you'll win in court. And so neutral principles of law allows people to say, this is abuse, this is the abuser. And, you know, truth is a defense to defamation. If I call an abuser and he sues me for defamation, neutral principles of law are still on my side. And so I think that neutral principles of law protect both sides of this, and that they don't allow churches to hide abusers, which they very frequently have, but they don't criticize churches that release abusers, right? The neutral principles are on the side of those who protect children. And I think if you put it that way to courts, most courts would say, yes, we're going to be with the victims and not with the abusers. But church autonomy does not always allow you to side with the victims or the survivors. It often protects the freedom to choose your minister, even if the minister is abusive or a sexual harasser or a discriminator. So I think neutral principles can take care of both sides of it.
thank you for the clarification there. I know it's obviously a very important interest, so something that we should be aware of. Alex, when disputes arise between members or leadership of churches or other religious entities, it can be difficult to disentangle secular issues from religious ones. So given that the Supreme Court has told us that religious entities have the right to decide for themselves matters of faith, doctrine, and internal governance without government interference, what are courts to do when they're faced with claims that may appear neutral, like a defamation or a fraud claim, but can't necessarily be resolved without wading into religious issues?
Yeah, thank you, Amanda. Yeah, there's actually a good deal of case law on this. Courts are permitted to decide defamation, fraud, and other tort claims so long as they can do so based on secular and neutral principles of law. But if the claims cannot be resolved without deciding questions of religious doctrine, then the courts are prohibited from adjudicating them. So take the context of defamation, for example. The Second Circuit recently strongly suggested, and correctly in my view, correctly in my view, that the church autonomy doctrine did not bar a minister's claim that church officials defamed him by falsely stating that he forged letters stating that he was elected to a position as a bishop. This type of claim can easily be resolved without deciding questions of religious doctrine. So the key factual issue in that case is whether the minister actually forged the letters or not. On the other hand, suppose that a minister files a defamation suit against church leaders, alleging that they falsely stated that he was incorrectly teaching the church's doctrines. This type of claim would plainly be barred because courts would have to determine whether the minister's interpretations of church doctrine were correct. And the same types of distinctions can be drawn in the fraud context. For example, suppose a minister asked his church's parishioners to make a special contribution of funds for repairs to the church's sanctuary, but he instead used the money to buy a private jet. A fraud claim based on these facts could proceed because it could easily be resolved without deciding questions of religious doctrine. On the other hand, suppose that a minister asks his parishioners to make a donation to support the work of God. The minister used the money to hire an assistant minister who delivered sermons that a parishioner disagreed with based on doctrinal differences. A parishioner's fraud claim alleging that the funds were not actually used to support the work of God would obviously require the resolution of religious questions and would be barred. Of course, there will be closer and more difficult examples than the one I just gave, such as the Huntsman case that Amanda discussed earlier. But the important thing to understand is that the church autonomy doctrine does not categorically bar defamation, fraud, or other kinds of tort claims against religious institutions.
Great. Well, thank you. Tom, turning back to you. So the Supreme Court's most recent church autonomy cases, Susanna Tabor and Our Lady of Guadalupe, both involved disputes between religious schools and their former employees. But as we've discussed, religious entities also invoke church autonomy in cases in which government entities make decisions that implicate religious issues. So how can governments effectively regulate religious entities without opening themselves and requiring the courts to resolve church autonomy claims?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a question about the scope of the church autonomy doctrine and what matters is it going to apply to. If you're talking about internal governance, that line has to be defined. Church leaders are a matter of internal governance. The development of doctrine is a matter of internal governance. Who can be a member is, and so on. But then there will be questions about other employees, obviously. Those with some religious duties, not necessarily as significant. How far does the ministerial exception go? Questions about effect on members in the abuse cases, and all sorts of other questions. I support the church autonomy doctrine, but I also have a certain amount of discomfort with it because of its absolute nature. Within the doctrine, it is categorical, right? So the ministerial exception there's no override for a compelling interest. the balancing between government interest and the church, the religious organization's interest has to be done by defining the scope of the category rather than by having a an override, because that's the way the court has structured the doctrine, and it probably fits that it should be categorical with the way Branton has described it historically, right? That we're talking about certain things in which the government should not be involved. That doesn't lend itself to a kind of, well, is there a sufficient government interest in the particular case to override it? So, I would like to see Employment Division versus Smith overruled and a return to a free exercise doctrine that did some balancing across the board in free exercise cases, because I think that would take some of the pressure off of the church autonomy, the pressure to expand the church autonomy doctrine. If you're in Smith land and there's no basis for a constitutional exemption other than because of Smith, then that's going to mean pressure on the church autonomy doctrine to expand to provide the protection that the free exercise clause in other cases won't provide. I don't think it's solely a matter of the court just always wanting the church to win or the religious organization to win. I think they're funneling some religious freedom protections into the church autonomy doctrine that could be done under a better free exercise doctrine. But of course, that's complicated as well because, well, the Smith doctrine has been chipped away at in pretty significant ways with decisions like the COVID cases, Tandon and Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn, and with the Fulton case about exceptions from government policies. Those trigger strict scrutiny. So this is a developing thing, and the court is considering whether to overrule Smith, and Justice Barrett asks, what would we go back to? But I think in general, we would probably be in a better place where we wouldn't have to put so much pressure on the absolute church autonomy doctrine if we had a somewhat more balanced free exercise doctrine.
Great. Well, what I'm hearing from a lot of these answers and just in your opening statements is there are a lot of questions. Hopefully we'll get a lot more percolation and some more clarity from the Supreme Court over time, but very interesting topic. And that also leads to our audience Q&A. We have quite a few questions that have come in. So I want to respect the panelists' time and try to wrap this up in the next 10 minutes, but let's just go through those. So one of our listeners mentions an Oklahoma case called Oklahoma United Methodist Conference Annual Conference v. Timmons or Nunn v. Timmons. Is anyone familiar with that case and able to speak to how the church autonomy doctrine is applied there? No problem. Well, we'll move on to the next one. So one of our listeners is talking about says he doesn't see any legal barriers to submitting religious disputes to arbitration. Because enforcement of any arbitration award would ultimately require civil court involvement. But given this procedural dynamic, how might principles of church autonomy function in practice? So I guess it says specifically, how could the courts balance deference to religious arbitration with their role in enforcing or potentially reviewing such outcomes? If anyone has thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I guess just briefly, it would be probably handled similarly to how courts handle. If the dispute can be resolved using neutral principles of law without the court or the arbitrator getting into religious issues, then there wouldn't be a violation of the church autonomy doctrine. But if it's an arbitration that basically goes outside the church environment and it requires resolution of religious issues, it would seem to be barred by the church autonomy, or also known as the ecclesiastical abstention principle.
You know, if Brandon mentioned a sort of third grounding of the church autonomy doctrine, and that is the idea of voluntary association. And we might say, like, in most cases, an arbitration arrangement is a voluntary agreement between the parties. Now, there are questions about arbitration that is forced upon parties and undue influence and unequal bargaining power and so on. But, you know, the answer on arbitration might be you contracted for the decision of the arbitrator. And actually, the general practice of courts is not to review arbitrators' decisions very, very closely. So maybe we don't need a special doctrine about review of religious arbitration. Now, we certainly need some limits on imposing unconscionable conditions on, especially women, for example, or children in family situations. It's not enough to say that that's been submitted to an arbitration, a religious arbitration. But absent that kind of unconscionability situation, religious arbitration might fit very well with the voluntarist conception of church autonomy, and judicial review isn't very powerful in either case, in the religious setting or the general arbitration setting.
Great. Well, moving on to the next, wasn't rejection of the government interfering in the choice of ministers one of the motivations for barring establishment of religion at the founding?
I think that's correct, but kind of going back to what Leslie was saying, that doesn't necessarily mean that the ministerial exception doctrine properly follows from history. I mean, the concern at the founding and the abuses that the religion clauses were meant to prevent really focused on the government favoring one religion over others, promoting particular religions, suppressing other religions. So if you do allow neutral employment anti-discrimination laws to be applied to all religions, then that would be a neutral rule that wouldn't necessarily, it might have some disparate impacts among religions, but it wouldn't be intended to favor any one religion over others. So I think there's a real question as to whether the ministerial exception doctrine is properly tied to history or goes beyond the historical reasons and the historical intent behind the religion clauses.
Got a question that is, sorry about that. Did I cut someone off?
No, I mean, I think James Madison was concerned about Baptist preachers being put in jail. It wouldn't have mattered to him if they were put in jail for secular reasons that weren't strong. It was not solely the fact that it was promoting another religion. The original thing that got the Reformation wars going was not a religiously based rule. You had to agree with the king's marriage. That turned into a doctrinal thing about whether the king was the head of the church and so on. But you had to agree with the king's marriage. Religiously neutral.
Well, let's try to get to two more questions.
It maybe raises the question of whether neutral principles is a necessary but not sufficient condition for overriding church autonomy. Maybe Leslie and Alex might have a reaction to that. But Hosea and Tabor, I know, rejected sort of the broad neutral principles view that neutral principles always trumps church autonomy. Neutral principles does seem to have the benefit of skating past getting civil courts entangled in religion. But I wonder if it raises free exercise type concerns. Maybe that's just an incidental burden point, like Alex points out. But I think my general reaction is neutral principles might be necessary but not sufficient.
Let's try to get to two more questions here. One broader one and then one specific to CCB. So One listener asked, how, if at all, is the church autonomy doctrine applied differently with respect to hierarchical entities, like he says, e.g. Catholics, and non-hierarchical entities, e.g. Baptists? So how would the church autonomy apply differently to those, if at all?
Well, there is a lot of difference as to who the church calls a minister. And the justices have disagreed on that, with Justice Thomas being strongest, saying we should just defer. If your church says you're a minister. And then the other argument is, well, if you do religious things, you're a minister. But it's true, it works out differently in different churches, with everybody even saying the word minister isn't really what gets it. So in Hosanna Tabor, there was a four-part test for who's a minister. But then in the newest case, it's really who's doing something religious, which is why the teachers at religious schools weren't really, the court said they weren't teachers, they were ministers, because they were in a religious school doing religious things, even though one of them said she wasn't doing religious things at all.
This last question is about Catholic Charities. So either Tom or Alex, will the employees of Catholic Charities in the upcoming Supreme Court case have any unemployment benefits if Catholic Charities wins? Do you all know the factual point there?
Well, they have their own unemployment compensation program, so that they certainly assert that the employees will have benefits. I mean, there might be issues as to whether the benefits are better or worse than what the state provides. I mean, the kind of the bigger issue that the case presents is that, like, lots of the impact of a ruling in the case, which would prohibit Wisconsin and lots of other states from limiting the scope of the exemptions to their unemployment tax statutes, and also lots of other tax statutes, be that lots of other employees would lose their rights to unemployment compensation and could lose various other types of rights, such as the rights not to be discriminated against, labor law protections. So the case overall could have inflict a lot of harm on people who are employed by or deal with religious institutions in other ways if the court rules in favor of Catholic Charities. And also, as I also said, that if the court adopts the petitioner's arguments, it could actually harm the freedom of religious organizations by creating a rule of law that could cause a lot of state legislatures to either refuse to adopt new religious exemptions or to even repeal existing ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think the second concern is a real one if the court doesn't find some sort of nuanced way of deciding the case. It is a complicated matter. There have to be lines that the legislature can draw. So it can't just be that, you know, any distinction that affects what the religion does. I agree. Is unconstitutional. I agree with Alex on that. But I think that various amici have provided a number of different ways for the court to say this particular kind of Frankenstein's monster of an opinion that the Wisconsin Supreme Court concocted about what constitutes a primarily religious entity. We can disapprove of that while still leaving a lot of ways for legislatures to draw lines. So that will be the challenge, and I hope that they will, you know, rise to that challenge. And I think they should rule for Catholic Charities, but they have to be careful about what they say.
Well, we will know soon enough. The case will be argued next week. So thank you all again for just being here, for participating in this conversation on church autonomy, which is a very timely issue. So we've talked about a lot of issues percolating through the lower courts. So thank you all for being here. Thank you to our audience. And without further ado, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.